Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Looks like even more trouble for what USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey calls
this troubled 2022 cotton crop.
Trouble indeed. And he says when you see just how much of the U.S. cotton crop is rated poor to very poor condition.
That is very sobering, to say the least.
Especially when you see what's continuing to happen to that crop.
Another big decline in condition this week. Just 31% of the cotton in the U.S. rated good to excellent, 40% very poor to poor. It's a 3 percentage point drop in the good to excellent categories, and a 5 percentage point increase in the very poor to poor categories.
Rippey stops short of pronouncing this crop dead, but he does say it's
too far gone to really appreciably recover this late in the season.
And keep in mind, the cotton condition ratings are based on expected harvested acres, not including what's going to be a large number of abandoned acres. Gary Crawford, Washington.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
3/4 of U.S. corn has reached the dough stage. That is 4 percentage points behind the 5-year average. That's 8 points behind where we were last year at this time, 83% dough stage.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey on corn.
Meanwhile, corn denting, 31%. 5-year average, 35%. Last year at this time, 38%.
And what about corn condition ratings?
We do have a couple of Midwestern states where more than a quarter of the corn crop is rated very poor to poor. Those are some of the states with the greatest maturity at this point. We have Nebraska coming in this week, 30% very poor to poor, Missouri, 28%, and then pretty close to that threshold, South Dakota, 22% very poor to poor. Notice those are all those Western Corn Belt states where it's been a hotter, drier summer than areas further north and east.
So that's the corn crop. Now let's turn to soybeans and get details of current conditions.
57% of the soybeans rated good to excellent, 13% very poor to poor. And the changes from last week on those numbers, 1 percentage point for each of those two categories. In other words, last week we're at 58% good to excellent and 12% very poor to poor. Now, looking at some of the individual states, we have seen those gradual improvements in some of those drier areas. We continue to still see a bit of a deterioration, though, in Nebraska. The week-over-week change in Nebraska, 22% very poor to poor this week, 20% was the number last week. But in Missouri, it went the other direction, 19% very poor to poor in Missouri, 22% was the number last week. So a little bit of a mixed bag depending on the areas that got the rain versus the areas that remain unfavorably dry.
And looking at progress of the soybean crop.
Quickly looking at the soybean progress, setting pods this week, 84%, 5-year average, 86% last year, 87%. And none of the states are particularly notable in the fact that they're not too far from the respective 5-year averages. So we're running a little bit closer to normal development pace on soybeans as compared to corn, which remains a bit behind.
But one crop that's just been decimated by the drought, cotton.
We see nearly 1/5 or 19% of the U.S. cotton bowls open. That is slightly ahead of the 5-year average of 18%. Even further ahead of last year's 13%, pretty wide range in cotton bowls opening across the country. We're still waiting for any bowls to open in California, where the 5-year average is 2%, and in Oklahoma, where the 5-year average is 7%. On the other side of things, we have leading the way, Louisiana, 43% of the cotton bowls open, 5-year average 38%.
Now, the crop that's grown usually side by side with cotton is sorghum, and Rippey explains.
Sorghum, another crop across the Great Plains that has just been ravaged by drought. Another decline in condition this week for sorghum. Just 1/4 of the crop currently rated good to excellent, down 2 percentage points from last week. 40% very poor to poor. That is up from 38% last week. A year ago, just like cotton, much better sorghum crop, 62% good to excellent, 10% very poor to poor. Of the 6 production states, 4 of them have very poor to poor ratings exceeding 40%. And that includes, of course, Kansas, Nebraska, Oklahoma, and Texas.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
I think eventually, as we go through, you know, the next few months, USDA NAS does have access to these certified acreage numbers as they come out. And as we know, the certified acreage report was actually delayed by about 10 days just because of the backlog, I guess, within USDA on some other programs that they've been developing and delivering. So there was a little bit of a delay on the certified acreage being released, and that may have impacted the NAS information just a little bit.
Sean Wade is with Plains Cotton Growers.
From a Texas perspective, comparing the two, the FSA numbers as far as planted acres on upland cotton, you know, appear to be higher than what NAS has on the books right now. So that, you know, that planted acreage number for NAS may well go up. But as we look at, again, you know, within this, you know, just everything that's going on, we know that there are more acres to be reported as failed in the state as well. And so, you know, the question is going to be, as those acres get reported into FSA and everything starts to, you know, kind of be balanced out, and compared one to the other, you know, what adjustments will NAS make over the next few months, if any, to kind of bring those acreage numbers in line? You know, there's certainly not a lot to point to that would say that NAS is really far off the mark, as far as their crop goes, unless, you know, like I said, maybe they're underestimating some of those acreages just a little bit. Which, you know, may have pushed, you know, what was a 12.6 million bale forecast for the U.S. You know, maybe there's some acres out there that when they get it all put back together, maybe we do, you know, crawl back up to a 13.2, million bale crop. I don't really know, you know, what that's going to look like. But we do know that we don't have all of the failed acres accounted for on the high plains of Texas, much less in the rest of Texas. And over the next month or so, you know, federal crop insurance will be switching from from stand counts to bowl count appraisal methods. So we'll likely see some of this cotton that, you know, it's to a stand, but it's, you know, it's just kind of been existing for the last few months. Once they can do bowl counts on it, they'll actually go in and try to do a yield estimate on what's out in the field. And we may see, like I said, we would expect to see maybe some more acres get failed out as well. So, can't say with much certainty that, you know, USDA NAS's crop report is off the mark by very much, but it may certainly see some adjustment as we go over the next few months.
So the cotton harvest is underway in Texas, but where are we with winter wheat? Brad Rippey with USDA.
Our last look at the winter wheat harvest for 2022 showing 95% of the crop harvested by August 21st, 2 points behind the five-year average, 4 points behind last year when we had 99% harvested by this date. Even with being the last report of the year, I will note that there is still substantial acreage remaining to harvest in parts of the Northwest, notably Idaho, just 45% harvested. Five-year average, 85%. Washington State, the only other of the major reporting states below 90%, coming in this week, 73% harvested behind the five-year average of 86%.
That's Brad Rippey with USDA. You're listening to Agribusiness News, Markets, and Weather. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
The first export exchange since 2018 is coming up in October in Minneapolis. I talked with Kelly Davis, RFA's Vice President of Technical and Regulatory Affairs. What countries are you looking at in particular that have the greatest promise for increasing markets for distillers' grains?
The countries they're targeting for this particular delegate trade team associations are from Northeast Asia, Korea and Taiwan and Japan. China will not be attending. Then the four Southeast Asia regions, Vietnam, Philippines, such as that. And there's Middle East and Africa, too, are developing areas where we would like to extend distillers' grains to. And then our trade partners, North and South Canada and Mexico. And Latin America is also a growing, developing market for distillers' grains.
What are some of the ways that you work with other countries to show them the nutritional benefits of distillers' grains as livestock feed?
Well, some of the things we do is very similar to like this export exchange. What we do is we'll have professors, you know, nutritionists at these conferences talking about the latest nutritional advances. As you well know, we've also been enhancing our co-products through other techniques. So you've heard of high protein DDGS and things like that. We are now going in and differentiating certain co-products and their nutritional profiles where they can be targeted towards something like growing like aquaculture or the growing poultry industry or the growing monogastric industry. So I think those are the type things that we share with our delegates, how we're moving along, the current nutritional information. We work with professors and their nutritionists overseas as well. We keep them apprised of current crop conditions and crop quality type conditions. Our delegates are also always interested in our policy matters. Believe it or not, it doesn't take too long to get back to regulatory type situations. I can remember in 2018, the Feed Safety Modernization Act was being implemented in full force here in the United States, creating animal food. And so therefore, we share that knowledge with our export partners so that they would benefit from that. And we talk about, we'll also have at the beginning of this conference, like price trends. You'll hear about production processes that are different. You'll also hear about how the markets are doing, things like that. These are very generalized things that all people who are buyers and sellers and actual customers, actual feeders, will actually be here at this conference too. And so the Grains Council does that year round, and they speak on behalf of most of the coarse grains in the U.S. like sorghum and corn. But distillers dried grains has always been one on their list too, to help educate potential people around the globe to purchase.
As far as here in the United States, the sellers, who are you inviting? Who would you encourage to attend this event?
Well, we certainly encourage any ethanol plant, all ethanol plants. There's like 200 dry mills across the U.S. who produce DDGS. Some people only produce wet products, so they're marketed locally, but most producers do dry their DDGS, and therefore they can be marketed globally. And so we have marketing companies. Some sell their own. Some ethanol plants market their own products, and some ethanol plants use marketing firms to aggregate distillers so that large quantities can be shipped overseas. So we would like anyone who has interest in buying and selling distillers grains, we would appreciate them coming to this conference.
I am Cindy Zimmerman.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
I'm dependent on Tester, my lead Democrat, and a very strong voice for this legislation, to work with Schumer to get the bill up in September.
Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley referring to whether or not a cattle bill could make it to the Senate floor.
It was supposed to be up in October, according to Tester. So was the Klobuchar-Grassley bill on Big Tech, was supposed to be up during July, and it didn't get up. So I'm going to answer your question from two standpoints. One, I just gave you the answer that I have to depend upon Tester. Secondly, you could imagine when we're up against the North American Meat Institute, we're up against about half of the National Beef Association because they're split on this issue, and then we're up against the big lobbyists for the four biggest meat packers. All this is strong voice in Washington that wants you to believe that we don't have enough votes. Now, I haven't done a recent vote count, but I don't have any reason to believe that we're in any worse position than we were when we got the bill out of committee on a voice vote, and we have 10 Republican, 10 Democrat co-sponsors. It seems to me like we're in a pretty strong position.
But even an act of Congress couldn't save our hay supplies, Dr. Darrell Peel, Oklahoma State University.
Hay production in Oklahoma is estimated to be down about 10% on a year-over-year basis. And, you know, on May 1, our hay stocks estimate was down almost 48%. So when you combine those two together, the hay supply for this year, the beginning stocks plus hay production, is down about 17%. And that's true in most of the major, you know, several of the major hay states, which are also big beef cattle states. A combination of either reduced May 1 supplies, which is really carryover impacts from drought earlier, plus reduced production this year, is leading to very tight hay supplies in all of this region and generally across the country.
And expect record prices.
Hay prices are already high. Again, we've had carryover impact from last year, but we're going to set record prices for alfalfa hay and for all other hay without a doubt.
At this point, even pasture conditions are suffering.
We've seen drought re-advance again this midsummer in Oklahoma. About two-thirds of our pasture is currently rated at poor to very poor. Just 9% is rated in good condition, and 0% is rated in excellent condition. So, you know, again, we're nearly through the growing season. It's going to be a long winter with a combination of not much hay and not much forage to work with.
And we knew it, but the herd is contracting.
We've already seen a lot of movement so far this year, but if you look in the last 4 weeks in Oklahoma, auction volumes for feeder cattle are up about 11%. Well, that would suggest that we're probably weaning calves early, moving cattle, those feeder cattle into town early. And then on the cull cow side, you know, again, we've seen really strong cow slaughter this year. The auction volume for cull cows in the last 4 weeks is up 115%, so more than double for the same period a year ago.
Yet the markets are strong.
You know, there is good news actually in prices in the cattle markets. Despite all of these impacts, despite the increased volume of cattle moving through the markets, prices are actually very strong. So we're seeing prices for feeder cattle advancing, and we predicted that generally. There's a trend of stronger cattle prices. Cattle numbers are getting tighter over time. And so despite these drought impacts, we're seeing stronger feeder cattle prices. And even the cull cow market with the volume we had, there was a couple of weeks in July when the volume really overwhelmed the market, and we saw prices drop briefly, but they've bounce right back and continue to be very, very strong at this point.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
An agreement to allow grain shipments from Ukraine is helping increase global supplies of wheat and corn. Veronica Nye, American Farm Bureau Federation senior economist, says several shipments are leaving Ukraine now.
Certainly with the establishment of the export corridor, we're starting to see a lot more ships leaving Ukraine than before. A total of 33 cargo ships have left Ukraine under the deal, with another 18 vessels that are now loading or waiting for permission to leave Ukrainian ports.
Nye says the exports are welcome but could stop at any time.
Just today, the U.S. government urged Americans in Ukraine to leave the country immediately, warning that Russia is stepping up efforts to launch attacks on civilian infrastructure and government facilities in the coming days. Obviously, that would impact Ukraine's ability to export products. So it's certainly a delicate situation, and that corridor could go away at any particular time.
However, the exports from Ukraine are improving global supplies.
USDA increased Ukraine's exports of wheat to 3 million metric tons, about half of where they were last year. But that was an improvement from the projections the month before the corridor existed. Each month, global production estimates are getting a little stronger as those crops fill out. USDA's projections for global wheat exports puts us up 5% this year relative to last year because some other major producers are having larger crop years. The global situation is becoming a little bit less tight than it was just a few months ago.
Michael Clements, Washington.
One of the largest export markets for U.S. pork and beef is just starting to emerge from COVID restrictions. U.S. Meat Export Federation President and CEO Dan Hallstrom recently returned from his first trip to the country in more than 2 years, and he says the residents are still pretty cautious.
On my way in, it was the most emptied I'd seen it ever. I think it'll take a little bit of time for the consumer in Japan to get used to the post-COVID environment because the government definitely does not want to shut down again. They want to keep things open. But the consumers, it's going to take a little bit of time for them to adjust and get used to that, I think. I was a bit surprised that food service hadn't recovered any more than it had. People are fully masked inside and outside. The family-style dining sector, especially the yakiniku sector, is seeing some rebound. But that isn't true for the whole food service sector. While food service is up, it's from a very low base a year ago. So I think there's a lot of upside later in the year for food service. Meanwhile, retail and online e-commerce activity continues to boom.
U.S. beef is very strong in Japanese food service, but Hallstrom says he talked with buyers who expressed growing interest in pork for retail.
From the standpoint that certain cuts are maybe a little cheaper than beef, and also the fact that poultry prices are so high in Japan, the chicken prices. So I think pork is well positioned in that regard. So there was a bit of optimism at retail in particular around pork. So that was encouraging.
The U.S. red meat industry has a long commitment to Japan that will be celebrated next month.
We are celebrating our 45th anniversary of our Japan office, established in 1977. And we will be holding a trade seminar on September 16th in Tokyo. And we're expecting to have upwards of 200 people. And this will be the first large business venture of this sort in a post-COVID environment. So it's not only a chance to celebrate the 45th anniversary, but more importantly, to tell our story, remind people of the strength of U.S. beef, pork, and lamb, for that matter.
For more, visit usmef.org. I'm John Harith.
Thanks, John. Finally, let's get an update on spring wheat. USDA's Brad Rippey.
Likely our next to last look at spring wheat condition, showing that even with some late declines in condition, a much better crop than last year. Currently now 64% good to excellent, 8% very poor to poor. A year ago, barely a tenth of the crop, 11% was good to excellent, and 63% was rated very poor to poor.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
The first export exchange since 2018 is coming up in October in Minneapolis, and members of the ethanol industry are invited to attend and connect with international grain buyers interested in ethanol co-products such as dried distillers grains. The biennial event, sponsored by the Renewable Fuels Association, the U.S. Grains Council, and Growth Energy, was canceled in 2020 due to the global pandemic, but it's back and better than ever in 2022. I talked with Kelly Davis, RFA's Vice President of Technical and Regulatory Affairs, about the export exchange and why ethanol producers should attend.
We definitely expect a big crowd. We'd have about 240 already registered, and we really haven't been getting the word out. We expect maybe up to 500 to join us in Minneapolis. The last time we were together was in 2018 and in Minneapolis, so we'll be back in Minneapolis. And at that time, we had a wonderful conference, and these are buyer-to-buyer type conferences with international delegations, and they have meetings that are scheduled with the sellers of distillers products here in the States, set up during the conference. And, the last time, I believe in 2018, I believe we did over $400 million worth of trades, during this export exchange in 2018. We expect it to be very similar. There's still a lot of excitement out there for American made products, and our distillers grains are one of those that the international community is very fond of.
Why is this so important for the ethanol industry to increase markets for distillers grains?
You know, I've been in the industry, Cindy, for a long time, and I can remember in the early 90s how we talked about if the industry grows, what are we going to do with all this distillers grains? And I think the industry has done a wonderful job playing off of research that came basically out of the beverage industry. And we have developed high protein products that are very beneficial nutritionally for farm animals. And so it didn't take long for us to figure out exporting one of our favorite partners in Canada. And the word gets out on the product of how nutritious it is. It's also very palatable for farm animals. And so the product is known around the globe to be very efficient. And we managed to get it to probably over 60 countries across the globe today.
What are the best markets right now for distillers grains?
Canada is always a top market. The North American, Mexico, Canada are good markets. But we also have developing markets in the Southeast Asian area is a growing market. Vietnam, places such as that, Japan, those areas will send delegations here for this particular conference.
What are some of the other ways that RFA works with the Grains Council to increase exports of DDGs year-round, not just during the export exchange?
Of course, the Grains Council has boots on the ground in numerous countries around the globe, and their foreign ag service agents do a great job of telling the story and explaining the nutritional values of distillers dried grains with solubles. They held a lot of Zoom conferences like a lot of us did through COVID, but we're now back to traveling again. Jeff Cooper was recently in Japan while I was recently in the Philippines. And so we really enjoy our relationship with the Grains Council, and that's how we get the word out across the globe on our products, DDGS, as well as corn gluten meal, corn gluten feed, other co-products around the industry. And we also work with the Grains Council on ethanol exports as well.
I'm Cindy Zimmerman.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The drought and high feed costs are pushing some cattle producers to reduce herd size, and several people we know have hinted that some cow-calf producers may be talking about just quitting the business. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack told reporters the other day in response to that,
"It doesn't surprise me that there are people thinking about getting out of the business. The reality is that's been true of agriculture for the last number of years. We've seen a consolidation and a reduction in the number of farms."
And USDA livestock analyst Shale Shagham told us,
"The ownership may cease. What do you do with the land? You know, in many areas, the cow-calf operators are raising cows and calves because it's not really suitable for grain. So do you simply sell your operation to somebody else who then continues to run cows on that land? Because in many cases, there are not a lot of alternative uses for that land."
And he says, besides, there's no way to know real time what's really happening to beef operations. We can only track cattle numbers, really, and watch what happens on that front. Gary Crawford, Washington.